Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined by two guests this week, one of whom is a return guest and one of whom is a first-time guest. First of all, we are joined by WIM Natasha Regan, who, of course, longtime listeners may remember, is the co-author of the outstanding books Game Changer and Chess for Life, in which she collaborated with Grandmaster Matthew Sadler. Natasha, of course, is a WIM, a two-time chess Olympian for England, 2023 England Women's Senior Chess Champion. She's also a Shogi and a Go enthusiast, and she is an actuary by day, so I don't know how she does it all. She and her co-author of the course we will be discussing, among other things, is a gentleman by the name of Matthew Ball. He is a publishing director of a newspaper about the art market called Antiques Trade Gazette. He recently got back into chess through his kids, as many of us do. He played as a youth. His kids struck an interest. And then all of a sudden, now he's a FIDE national instructor. He's coaching at his school's club. He's a dedicated improver. He's managed to achieve the rare feat of gaining rating points into his 50s. So we're going to have plenty to talk about. We also, of course, should mention that together they are the co-authors of a brand new chessable course called Zwischenzug, a comprehensive guide to intermediate moves, which, as they correctly, I believe, identify in the course, it might be the first dedicated literature to one of the coolest chess tactics out there, to my mind. And speaking of Chessable, did want to give them a quick shout out. They are the presenting chess education sponsors. A couple other new courses to check for. Of course, recent guest Grandmaster Ben Feingold, friend of the pod, Hans Schutte, finally has his Milner-Barry course, which I've been waiting for as someone who scored a lot of points with the Milner-Barry when I was a kid, although these days engines are not as kind to it as my opponents were back in the day. But I'm excited to check that one out as well. You can check out all my recommendations. There's a link in the show description. But without further ado, let's welcome our guests. First up, welcome back, Natasha.
Thank you very much.
And welcome, Matthew.
Great to be here. Thank you very much, Ben.
Yeah. So for listeners, we're going to come clean. We had a few tech issues and Matthew just walked us through his whole resurgence, which I had known some details of. But Matthew, so basically your daughter found a trophy and got you back into chess through that?
Yeah, she was of an age where she liked shiny things, saw one in the cabinet, said, "How'd you get that?" I said, "Well, I got it playing chess." "Well, you have to show me how to do that because I want to win these things." So I had to teach somebody chess, and then of course I had to teach her younger brother chess as well. They started playing tournaments, and one day my wife entered them in the local chess congress and said, "Well, I've put your name down for it as well, because otherwise you're just going to be sitting around all day waiting for them to finish their games." So I had to play the games, and I was unrated player in the bottom section, and I got 3.5 out of 5, which was okay. But really, for the next week, I couldn't stop thinking about the 5 games I'd played. It was quite a buzz, and kind of reminded me of how it was in my youth. And I've just gone on from there and continued to play tournaments and also develop a coaching streak.
Yeah, it seems like I admire that you've gotten into chess from so many angles, as we'll be discussing. And what year was it that this occurred with your daughter, Matthew?
I guess that was probably around 2013 that she started, something like that. And then this chess congress where I played was 2018.
Okay. And Natasha, I understand that you had played Matthew as a kid, and then you guys went to university together, and then eventually your paths crossed again. Is that all correct?
That's right. So when I was learning chess, it was in an English county called Buckinghamshire, not far from London. And I joined my local junior club, so Chalfont Chess Club, and we played matches against all the local schools. Matt's school was Royal Grammar School, High Wycombe, if I remember right. And we had lots of matches against the school. Now, Matt was really quite a fearsome opponent in those days. And so none of us wanted to play against him. We must have played quite a few times over the years when I was a teenager.
Well, I was going to ask, and then when who recognized who when you guys saw each other again?
I think it must have been you, Matt, recognized me, right? Because I think we came along to Matthew Sadler and I went to do a coaching session for the juniors at one of Matt's local tournaments when we just brought out Chess for Life. I think that was about the time. You had one of our books, I think, Matt.
Yeah. Well, I managed to get it autographed, which was good. I mean, we were at the same university at the same time, but we didn't actually know each other was there. So, you know, those kind of 3-4 years passed us by, if you like. And so it's much more recently that our paths have crossed again. So yeah, first with a kind of book signing at an event, and then last year we kind of both signed up to play in the England squad at the World Senior Teams Championship. So we kind of just saw each other in the bar of the hotel in Italy, which was a bit surreal.
Oh, nice.
But it was a really nice tournament. I hadn't played in like an international seniors event before. But it was like a really nice atmosphere. We went with a squad of about 30 players, probably more, from England. And sort of everyone knew each other or got to know each other. And it's sort of a slightly different atmosphere it's a little bit less serious when you're at senior level. Although our open team, so that was like Michael Adams, Nigel Short, Mark Hebden, Keith Arkle, John Ems, they were very serious about winning as well as having a nice time, but it was like all of us were kind of staying together in the same hotel and it was very sociable. So it was just kind of really nice because I'd known those players really since my teens, like all of those players, and we'd all kind of got older together, got to senior level together. So it's sort of very nice. And then they became the Open champions, and the women's team also, we became the women's champions at that event. So it was just really good atmosphere.
Yeah, it sounds great. And actually, Natasha, it segues right into a Patreon mailbag question from a supporter of the podcast. This is from David Lazarus, who helps run the Westfield Chess Club. If anyone is in the North Jersey area, North New Jersey, that is, it's well worth getting into their weekly events. Now, David asks Natasha, he says, he wonders if you have a different strategy when you're playing seniors as opposed to playing against kids.
Yeah. Well, I do kind of. When I've played kid, well, I definitely remember this one game and I was playing a kid, and what I'd always heard was that kids don't play end games so well. And I just remember I was playing this game at King's Place. It was a quick play in London, very nice event. And I was playing this tiny kid, and I decided I'd just swap everything off into the end game and just win the end game. But unfortunately, this kid was really, really good at end games, and actually it completely backfired, and from an even position I ended up losing. But against seniors, I think what I feel like might be true is I don't need to worry so much about the opening theory, in that I could still attempt to play sharp lines and be okay. And I know I think John Nunn has commented on that as well, like, because he always, like, all his life he's played these very kind of sharp E4 lines, lots of theory. And he likes playing the senior events where he can play whatever lines he likes, and it's not so bad. But before you get the wrong idea, actually the senior events, these people are very well prepared actually when you go into the game. So we had typically, like, the game would be in the afternoon and you have the morning to prep up for your games. But I've played in the Worlds and the European seniors, and in both events, your opponents typically know all about what you do, and they've prepped well for the game. So it's not that they don't know any theory, but you feel like you just feel a bit. I feel a bit more confident in being able to experiment a little bit more compared with events with juniors.
Yeah, as we were talking about before we're recording, I'm finalizing my book draft, and I do have a chapter in there about playing against kids. And a lot of the advice you shared, Natasha, has been sort of the received wisdom over the years, and
yeah,
I echo some of it. But I also felt like a little disingenuous as I sat down to write it, because I'm like, well, wait a minute, these days, like, the kids beat me all the time, you know. And a lot of the tips you might hear, like,
yeah,
you know, take them to the end game, you know, in sports they call it, like, taking the air out of the ball. You don't want it to be a dynamic game. But these days, I'm not sure if there's any way around it. They just play so well. And Matthew, I know that you've played some senior events, but you, at least through the lens of your kids, get to see kids play as well. Are you competing against kids in some of your events as well, Matthew?
Yeah, they will enter open tournaments rather than just the kind of age-gated junior events. And that's often a way for them to gain experience, but also rating points more quickly. Actually, these days, I find a lot of the children around similar age to my kids say they no longer really enjoy playing the junior tournaments as much, because it's the same players, they've seen them for years, and they need a bit of variety, and they feel less pressure when they play in the open events.
Okay.
So that's been an interesting change. Probably when they're younger, when they're kind of under below the age of 12 or something, you know, they'll play in whatever tournaments with the age range, but increasingly they want to play in open tournaments and have a variety of opponents, and that will include adults, but they'll often come up against other juniors. I think I found, again, for probably the children below the age of 12 early on, they could play a lot of book openings, but there'd come a point when they needed to slow down and take 5 or 10 minutes on a move because it was the key position, but they would still be playing at the same speed, and you'd be looking out for that position and that move as a potential game changer in your favor.
No pun intended.
I do have special opening that I play against certain kids. I probably shouldn't give this away at all.
Oh, no, this sounds like the good stuff.
yeah. So there's this opening. I wrote a trends book, like, years ago in the birds opening, which isn't considered to be that great an opening. So this is 1F4. And then you kind of go into some kind of a bit like a Leningrad reverse. So you finchetto your bishop and develop an attack. But this opening works well against people that play E4 themselves, so they don't know D4 systems so well, and particularly kids, all right, because they probably will have played E4 only. And so F4 on move one against kids that only play E4, that has worked really well in the past, even quite strong kids. So that's my little trick, but
okay. Yeah, well, I'll try anything.
Yeah. And you just kind of do a slow positional build up on them, and they might go like queen c7 and e5 too early, and you open up the center. But that's one kid specific opening, but it never works against adults at all.
Okay. And Matthew, I do think you're onto something there with what you mentioned about their sort of tendency to fly through a position, because I've noticed that as well. And they don't trip up that often because they're tactically sharp, but it's at least if they were like patient and sharper, it would just be on. And you do come across kids like that, but a lot of them do just kind of move right away and generally play good moves. But at least it gives you hope that you can spring a trap at some point. And, you know, I would ask you guys if, because here in the US, there's been a lot of talk here on the podcast and just generally, it feels like all these strong kids are improving quickly and they're entering the tournament pool, the rating pool, and they're kind of dragging down ratings of the existing players. And, you know, old codgers like me complain about it a lot. And I would ask you guys if that was the case too, except I'm friends with Grandmaster, Facebook friends with Keith Arkell, who's been on the show as well. And I've seen his post. He says, you know, like, I got congratulated for winning a tournament and I lost, you know, I lost rating points while winning this tournament, because he said you guys are experiencing the same phenomenon over there.
There's a certain extent of that, but if that's the new normal, then we just have to get used to it. There's no way I can complain about it, because I take two children to tournaments and they'll play in an open section at some point. So I don't mind playing juniors. It's fine. I'll just get on with it.
Yeah.
Mm. There's definitely a lot of it in England that there are definitely underrated juniors at the moment. And I think one of the things is we want to get more FIDE rated tournaments that junior players can play in, just in order to correct it. So there's been the few years with COVID where they haven't been able to play as many rated games as they might normally. And so things we talked about within the English Chess Federation is how to get a better provision of rated games for junior players, which will sort of help correct that a bit. I mean, for me, I sort of don't really watch my rating anymore, and it doesn't bother me at all. And if I'm going to give away points, I'm happy to give them to juniors. And actually, I've played in sometimes like a junior training event, and we play rapid play games, and they say, well, can you play against all the kids? And you know, you're gonna right, take an absolute pounding at this event, but I actually really enjoy it. And so I don't mind too much, but definitely there's certain tournaments where the adult players are just happy if they keep their rating the same and against the kids. And I also, even just this weekend, an international master who wants to become a grandmaster, he was talking to me, and he said, well, I'm going to wait a few years until I become actually a senior player, and then I think I'll go for my grandmaster, my bid for grandmaster, because then I can get my rating up a bit easier.
That's probably,
I said, watch out for these senior players. They're also good. Don't you worry.
Yeah. Well, you guys both have good perspective on not letting it bother you. But yeah, that's probably not the worst idea that the guy has. Well, Matthew, on a sort of related topic, I want to talk about chess improvement a bit, because you did mention you got back into it in 2013. It sounds like you discovered the great book Chess for Life, which, for listeners who aren't familiar, Natasha and I, in an interview that I did with Natasha and Matthew concurrently, we discussed the book some. But speaking of being the first in its field, to my mind, it might have been the first book sort of about adult improvement. Definitely the first I recall sort of profiling adults trying to get better at chess. And it's just as relevant today as ever. Now, so Matthew, I know you guys mentioned you had that book, but how else did you sort of begin to wrap your head around how to get better at chess once you got back into it?
Yeah, I've used a variety of techniques. I've focused quite a lot on tactics once I kind of got some kind of opening repertoire together. And I've used the woodpecker method quite a bit to go through the step method books. So I'd take something like step 3 or step 4. I'd take that book. It's got about 600 puzzles in, and I'd do the whole book in 4 weeks. And then I'd do it again in 2 weeks. And then I'd do it again in 1 week. And then 4 days, 2 days, and 1 day, and then take a break at the end of that. And then I'd start to find all those tactics popping up in my games, whereas before I wasn't finding them. So I found that to be almost like a bit of magic.
Wow.
It requires some dedication to put in that amount of effort on one book. If you're watching this on YouTube, this is step 4, and when you do it 6 times, the whole thing eventually falls apart as you've been leafing through it so much and holding it so much. But I found that very effective way of training tactics. And I just look at the puzzles in the book. I don't set them up on a board or put them online. I will just try and visualize all the way to the end and then check the answers later on. And that's been very good for me. And more recently,
okay, just, well, hold on, slow down. We got to get a few more details on that. Because you're combining, of course, a few sort of touchstones that come up here on the pod, one being the woodpecker method and spaced repetition, but also the chest steps method, which of course is, as we've mentioned many times, a Dutch curriculum that you can order, as Matthew just showed, for those who are watching, these little workbooks that aim to take you from beginner all the way up to about 2200. But my question, Matthew, is how long did this take? Like, how many hours a day were you spending when you were repeating all of the puzzles over compressed periods of time?
Sure. Well, to start with, it's not quite so hard. The biggest challenge is actually getting started and believing that you can finish it. So if there are about 600 puzzles in the book over 4 weeks, that's 150 in a week. So 22 puzzles a day, right? That's two pages of the book. It's about 11 on each page. So if you want, you could do one page with breakfast in the morning and one page when you got home in the evening after work or school. And you could get through the whole book in 4 weeks that way. That's not too hard. And then when you come back to it and you've got to do it in 2 weeks, well, that's two pages in the morning, two in the evening. And if you psychologically chunk it up like this, it's not quite as hard as it might look. And now you're familiar with the puzzles, you solve them much more quickly. And then you get a week. So now I've got to do four pages in the morning, four in the evening. That's okay. I've solved these puzzles twice already. And then we keep going. But as you get down to 2 days and 1 day, you need to plan your diary a bit. So on the day which was completing the whole book in 1 day, I would make sure that's a weekend. And I'd get up at 6 a.m, solve for 3 hours in the morning, and then solve for 3 hours in the evening. And I was done.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, it is a significant time investment, especially considering, sure, your family obligations, but not 3 hours every day. So,
no, and it, as I hope I've outlined there, you can get started with just, you know, a page in the morning, a page in the evening, and I think if you can begin with the end in mind, which is there's a day coming up in about 7 or 8 weeks' time where I'm just going to solve this book in a day. I'll have solved the puzzles 5 times already. I've just got to have 5 or 6 hours to myself to do this. Then you just work towards that. And it's not as daunting as it sounds, but it really does work if you put the effort in and you just suddenly start seeing these positions in your game. It's fantastic. But, you know, it requires a bit of planning and a bit of dedication, but it's worth the effort.
We'll be back in a minute to hear more about the woodpecker method, Zwischenzugs, and more.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. Of course, as Neil Bruce and I did a podcast about the woodpecker method and sort of its predecessor, Rapid Chess Improvement, that's a couple years old, but listeners can still find. And they do mention in the intro to the woodpecker method that you can use different materials pitched at a different level, because the woodpecker method, even the easier puzzles, are reasonably challenging. So is that how you came to using the step method for your repetition, Matthew?
Well, I got into this by reading Axel Smith's Pump Up Your Rating book, which
great book, yeah,
would certainly be on, maybe the top book I would recommend of all the hundreds on my bookshelf in the other room behind me. And I read about it there. Then I actually got the Woodpecker Method book itself, and I applied that method to the first 400 puzzles, which I was just doing when I was just commuting each day on the train to work back and forth. And then I'd also discovered the step books, which I was using for some of my coaching. And then I thought, well, hold on a second. I could use this. I could apply this to step books for myself, because there's a particular standard of the step book that's relevant for me. And I could just get on with it. So I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And yeah, it's been really good. So this summer's project will be step 5.
Wow. Oh, you already did step 4 too.
Yeah, yeah. I've done step 3, step 3 extra, step 4 extra, I think, something like that.
Wow. Step 5 gets pretty hard. So you'll have to report back to us on that. And Natasha, so you mentioned a lot of the tournaments you're attending, there's a decent chance for preparation. Especially, I think, in senior events, you might know who your opponent's going to be in advance. And I know you've got, you know, you mentioned before we started recording, you're working 4 days a week as an actuary. You're interested in Shogi and Go. So this is a long way of asking you, are you doing some sort of tactics work too? Or is that not happening at the moment? And don't feel bad, because I haven't been doing my tactics lately.
I do find tactics is very helpful in the lead up to a tournament. And so like for the senior stuff, then if I'm doing it sort of every day for 2 weeks in advance, then that's good. And obviously I've been writing this course, so I've been doing a stack of tactics just by doing that, because I've been playing through every time it comes up on Chessable. I've been playing through the tactics in the course, which I feel like has made me a whole lot sharper, because I do also do chess streaming and commentary, and so with that, so sometimes I'm like commentating together with a grandmaster or title player, and that also helps as well, because then I'm looking at the position, I think about what I'm thinking is the right moves to do, and then whoever I'm commentating with might be saying a different idea or saying tactics there, and then you get what moves the people actually play. So that helps to keep me sharp as well. But what I would say with playing other games is that I have this sort of time. If I go from one tournament to a different tournament in a different game, I have to take like a day or two to just switch my focus. I actually find it quite hard switching between the games, and I need to do the tactics of the different games just to get my head in the right place to go, say, from, I guess, chess to shogi and back is one of my frequent switches. And then, yeah, so tactics is definitely a very good training. I do some learning openings, but I'd say the tactics is the thing I find really makes a difference if I do that just before a tournament.
Yeah, I can't imagine what it must be like switching between games. So sorry, Natasha, I know you out of Shogi and Go, you got into one of them more recently. Can you remind me which one
exactly
is the recent passion?
Yeah. So I've obviously been playing chess for years and years. I got into Go in 1999, so way back. I learned it, and then actually for a whole year, I played no chess at all and just played Go, and got, I was doing Go problem books and Go strategy sort of all the time for that year. I got really, really into it, and then played tournaments and went all around Europe to play tournaments and all sorts of things. We wrote Game Changer. And Game Changer was about AlphaZero, and AlphaZero had learnt chess, Go, and Shogi, and learnt them all to superhuman level. And then I thought, well, I know chess and I know Go, and I've played both of those for England, but I've never played Shogi at all. And actually, one of the guys at DeepMind knew a tiny bit of Shogi. I mean, we're both complete beginners, really. But he said he would play some Shogi games with me. So we started off sort of in the DeepMind office and just kind of played pretty much at random, but we kind of knew the moves. And then I got really hooked on Shogi. So that was in, I guess, late 2018, early 2019. I was learning Shogi. Matthew Sadler learned it as well. We both improved really, really fast. And we played in, there was like a British Championships they had. And actually Matthew got to the, he was in the playoff for the final. He got to the final. So he was very nearly British champion at Shogi, having learnt only like a year before. But he did a lot of, yeah, he did a lot of studying the tactics and studying positions as well. But then I did on last year, 2022, I played in the European Shogi Championship. And I was the top woman there. So I was very pleased with that. But it's a kind of a lovely game. If you already know chess, it's quite easy to pick up in that some of the pieces are exactly the same. So like the rook's exactly the same, the bishop's exactly the same. And some of the pieces are a bit different. It's got a very much a forward bias and an attacking bias as well. So pieces can go forwards much easier than they retreat. And what you can do when you take a piece, you can, it goes from the opponent's army into your army. So then as your move, you can drop it on the board. So it's a little bit like Crazy House at chess, where you can drop a piece back on the board. But it's really good game. I thoroughly recommend it to your viewers, in that there's no draws. It's all kind of checkmates and tactics. And actually some of the tactics in chess and some of the tactics in Shogi are similar, but there's also things that will throw you off. So for example, pawns in chess take capture diagonally, whereas pawns in Shogi capture forwards. And so if you go straight from one game to the other, and then you kind of feel like you're defending your queen with a pawn from, it's just the square behind it. And for example, so you can get these kind of blind spots where you're confusing the two games. And I've heard like some top chess players that also play Shogi have made sort of blunders by thinking the pieces move like the Shogi pieces instead of the chess pieces. But yeah, there are players that are very good at both. So there's like a Japanese Shogi player who also got to IM level at chess and was playing some of the English players.
He got there quickly, if I recall correctly, right?
He got there very quickly. And also then you can, even when you, if you play through his games, the way he beat a friend of mine, Grandmaster Peter Wells, and he did it by doing this kind of sacrifice and then pieces in and checkmate, which is exactly a Shogi kind of attack. So some of the attacks you do in it's big on deflection attacks as well, Shogi. So you just kind of drop a piece, deflect the king, and then take something, and those kind of attacks you kind of all about the initiative as well. So you don't want to take material only. You want to keep that initiative, keep attacking in Shogi. And so it kind of trains you in that, the sort of value of having the initiative, always knowing where the opponent's king is and keeping focused on the king, as opposed to just kind of trying to mop up material.
And let me ask you, Natasha, so when you try to get better at Shogi, is there like a clear consensus about what you should do?
Well, now, one thing is there's not so much material in the English language. So most, you know, because Shogi's, most of the really top Shogi players are Japanese. There's a lot of material in Japanese. However, there's a very good stream in the English language by the only European professional player, or she was professional, Karolina Stajinska. She's a Polish player. And she has this stream called Shogi Harbor. And her sort of aim is to help Western players become better at Shogi. But she did a lovely stream that your viewers might be interested in, which was, there was this game in the World Shogi League between Peter Heine Nielsen, as in Magnus II, and Matthew Sadler. And they were playing in Division 2 of the World Shogi League, and they had a big match. So she commentated on this match, and lots of Shogi players and chess players watched that, which was lots of fun.
Fun stuff. I'm scared to get into another game. Yeah. I don't know where I would find the time. Matthew, are you tempted?
Well, I've still got plenty of chess to learn, so I'm focusing on one game for now. I did buy my son a Go board and set, and we had a few games, and he just completely wiped me out. So I know my limitations.
Okay, that makes sense. And bringing it back to chess, Matthew, so you mentioned steps method, lots of tactics, Pump Up Your Rating, which I agree is a great book. Any other standout recommendations? Mm-hmm. Because I know that you've made good progress in your 50s, as I mentioned in the intro.
Yeah, I use Chess Mood. Really like the way that's put together and presented, and they're always adding new content. I do use Chessable for a lot of my opening repertoire, and so I get a lot from that. I will do tactics on chess.com or Lee Chess, and try and get a kind of higher score on that. Puzzle Rush Survival on chess.com I quite like, you can think for as long as you want. It's not the 3 or 5 minute one. You get as long as you want to solve each one. So you can right. even just take a break and come back to it, and kind of get a bit of a buzz once you get over a particular number and see yourself on the global leaderboard for the hour. That's that's quite good fun. So yeah, all of those things, and I read a lot of other chess books as well. So some recent ones I've enjoyed: Invisible Chess Moves. I found that quite inspiring, and based some coaching lessons off some ideas in that, just ways of thinking differently about particular situations and tackling blind spots. I've enjoyed that sort of thing. And the other thing I do is when I'm coaching, I'm coaching my class at the local chess club, I always try and pick topics where I'm going to learn something as well.
That's a good idea. And how often are you managing to compete, Matthew?
Good question. I might do up to somewhere between 5 and 10 tournaments a year, but I also play in the local chess league for my local club, where I'm captain of one of our teams, and so that's probably once a fortnight we have a match.
The more British people I interview, the more jealous I get of the leagues.
Oh, and we have cup competitions as well, so we keep busy with all of that. And then I play for the county, the kind of equivalent of a state in America, for the under 1850 team, and we have matches against other counties.
There's quite a
lot going on, and the season really runs September to June, and then we kind of gear up for the British Championship, which is usually late July.
Okay. And Natasha, so you mentioned you were running through some of the Zwisch and Zug puzzles in some of your tactical work, but where does this collaboration enter the picture? Like, what's the origin story of the Zwisch and Zug course?
Yeah, so that was the idea of the topic was Matt's idea, but actually a friend of yours, wasn't it, Matt? A chap called Ray.
A chap called Ray Cannon. We were... I was at a rapid play tournament that both Natasha and I have played in. And Ray said, oh, let's analyze the game that you just lost. And we were moving some pieces. And then I said, oh, I took, he took, and we played on. He said, you didn't look for the intermediate move. Put the pieces back on the board. You didn't look for the intermediate move. You just took them off. You know, that's not analyzing. Slow down. Takes. Was there an intermediate move? You tell me. It doesn't matter if there was or there wasn't. You have to look for it. And this happened a couple of times during this analysis, and I was getting a good telling off from Ray. In his day, used to play against English GMs and so on. So he's a very good player. And I promised him that from then on, I would not only look for the intermediate move, I would do a series of lessons at my chess club on intermediate moves, just to drill it into me as well. And then as I researched this topic, I just found it more and more interesting. But I found I couldn't quite get exactly the material that I wanted. And so I needed to make kind of more of my own. And the sessions went well with the kids and so on. But I just thought there's more to this topic than I've been able to cover.
And we were talking about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought it sounded really interesting. And so you kind of showed me some of the Zwisch and Zugs you'd found. Yeah. And so we looked for some more, and just from the database. So first of all, we started off by searching in annotations to see if we could come up with some more interesting positions. And when you do it like that, you actually get a different type of tactic. So like traditionally the tactics you might see in books is very highly tactical sequence, where someone takes something, then you do something instead of recapturing. When you look in annotations, then you quite often get a bit more of a positional, I say puzzle, but a position, you know, positional sequence, because it might be throwing in a pawn move to attack a piece to get it onto a slightly different square. And then all the pieces happen to be in the right positions in order to make a tactic work, or even in order to get some kind of positional gain. So looking for those terms, and we also search for intermezzo and intermediate move, and looking for all those terms, pulling out all the games, what we did was then play through them all. And then I thought, well, we've got to put these in a spreadsheet and actually categorize them. And so then it was like, first of all, we were looking at patterns. No, first of all, no, that why it was a forcing move, and which patterns. And then I was also coding in sort of what is the outcome. So does it lead to material checkmate, or just getting your pieces further forward, all these sorts of things. And then once we'd written those all up, there were these themes that were occurring again and again, and this actually was then really, really interesting, because then we grouped them according to the themes, and we grouped them according to the outcomes, and we grouped them according to the forcing moves. And this then, particularly the patterns, I think we found the same sort of patterns on the chessboard. So when I say patterns, it could be, I think, one we hadn't really been expecting, although you might think it's obvious, you do get checks on the diagonal up to the king, the castle king. It was happening really a lot that there was an intermediate move that involved a check on the castle king. And then there were some other patterns, and actually one I want to tell you about is really nice, where this happened in the Ding Nepo match, and it also happened, there was a mistake in the Carlsen Anand match, and this is one particular setup of pieces, and Matt came up with a name for it, which was he's called it connected rooks. In this case it was rooks, and that's where you have two rooks lined up, a black rook and a white rook on the same row with one piece in between of that same color. And so the idea is you can move that piece out of the way with tempo, and then you're uncovering attack on the other piece. And by calling it this name, like connected rooks, connected queens, connected bishops, I've certainly found it really, really helpful now in looking at a position I haven't seen before, because the first thing I do, like even when I'm commentating or whatever, I say, there's connected queens. And, yeah. And so immediately I'm looking out for this piece moving out of the way. And so it's helped me become, in those kind of positions, become a whole load sharper. We've got another one a bit like that, which we called mutual emprise, and that's if your queen's attacked and their queen's attacked, or two pieces of a similar value. And then if you've got that situation on the board and it's your move, it's really quite often that there's a tactic. So you might be able to say, move your queen out the way and give a check, or attack a different piece, or whatever, but have a forcing move. And then you can go back and take their queen. So I think chess players will kind of know instinctively about these positions, like mutual emprise, but having a name for it, it's kind of made it, for me anyway, made it a whole lot easier to spot when I'm doing tactical puzzles, or when I'm doing commentaries or playing in my own games. I'm just sort of a lot more alert about that kind of position, then opening up the possibility of tactics that I might not previously have thought about looking for.
Yeah, I noticed in going through the course that you guys had a lot of creative names, and I do think it makes a difference in terms of one's ability to memorize it. So I don't know where did you guys come up with, when did you realize that needed to be included? And then how did you come up with all the names? And either one of you could take this.
Yeah, so I think as we were categorizing them, and realizing each of these was going to be a chapter in the Chessable course, it made sense to call the chapter something interesting. And, you know, one of the things I'm always doing with my coaching is, it's not just got to be challenging, it's got to be fun, it's got to be engaging, and it's got to be a little bit different. And I kind of like coming up with catchy names for stuff. And, you know, kind of looking at techniques used by world memory champions, it's kind of the crazier the association, the more likely you are to remember it. Whether it's kind of boring and bland, you can't really strike an association with it. So I'm always looking for these little connections and ideas for different to call different things. You know, we have one at my chess club. In every chess book, it will be called Cosio's Mate, but no one can remember what that is, right? Let alone who was Mr. Cosio. So at our chess club, we call that King in the Pocket, where the king is kind of in this little pocket with two pawns, and you put a queen diagonally next to it. And all the kids can say, oh, that's a King in the Pocket mate coming up. No one ever says it's Cosio's mate. So with all due respect to Cosio and his anti-Roy Lopez opening, if you can find a name that people can associate and remember with it, they'll just find it much more easy on the board. And it's interesting hearing Natasha say that, because, you know, she's a great tactical player. It's really one of her strengths in her game. And if this is working for her, it really should be working for everybody.
Yeah, I actually am looking up Cosio's Mate, because, of course, I've read books like How to Beat Your Dad at Chess. And I'm a big fan of the Checkmate Patterns Manual, as I actually talk about. But I tend to gloss over the names, too. I recognize the patterns. But yeah, the names, some often, if it's just like some, you know, some dude, and, you know, for better or for worse, it usually is a dude from 300 years ago. It doesn't necessarily, you know, evoke anything.
No, I got one last season. I was down to 5 seconds on my clock, and my opponent just put his king in the perfect position, and my head was going, that's king in the pocket, stick it in there. And I got to the mate before the time ran out. So it's a fruit of my own labors coming back to help me.
We'll be back in a minute with more from Natasha and Matt.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are back. For anyone listening who might be interested in the course, what rating level would you guys say it's pitched toward?
Yeah, it's. I think it covers quite a large range, because we start with basic puzzles, but actually the top level puzzles are, well, we had sort of 2,200 player doing a whole lot of testing on the course, and there were definitely ones that he wasn't able to solve, and he was getting stuff out of it. So I'd say from lower end, Matt, what would you say?
I think from 1,500-1,600 up, it's very accessible. But I mean, you could do the forcing moves chapter below that. But yeah, you can certainly get above 2,000 and still get a lot out of it, particularly the master games section, which was certainly Natasha's inspiration.
I definitely feel like I've learned a lot out of it. A couple of players that were stronger than me also were testing it, and also there was a lot of stuff they didn't know first time.
Okay. And so you mentioned, Natasha, it's made you feel sharper. Now, do you have any tournaments coming up? Like any chance to test this?
Yes, I do. Yes. I've got the European senior teams in Poland. So that's less than a month's time. I'm playing in that, and then also the British Championship after that. So yes, a couple of tournaments coming.
Those are big events.
Yeah.
I think we may end up in the same section in this weekend tournament at the British. So we'll see how that goes.
Is that the British Championships, Matthew, where you're referring to?
Okay. Yeah, in late July, yeah.
Okay. And I know that I believe they've changed the format at different times over the years. Like, is it an open tournament these days? How is it structured?
Yeah, so they have a championship section and a major open. And also then sort of rating limited tournaments. They have seniors tournaments, juniors tournaments, and also rapid play and blitz. So they've got a whole lot of different events on. And I think this year it's two weekends and one full week. So that's for working people, that's a lot easier than having when you have two full weeks and then the weekend in between.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so, Natasha, you mentioned earlier, so as you get ready for a tournament, it's primarily tactics that you're working on?
Yeah, tactics plus, I mean, I might learn one new opening for a tournament. I would not try and learn too many new openings because I wouldn't remember them all, but I maybe learn one opening depending on. Yeah,
so you might play something you've never played.
Definitely tactics. Definitely. So I actually do often play things I've never played before. Excuse me. And the reason for that, right, is actually, you know, as I play so many different games as well, I sort of am quite used to improvising and playing things from positions I don't know. I actually like that. I find that quite interesting if I can play from a position I don't know. The thing with chess though is it's you can't always do it because you can just get into a position that's lost before you've really had much chance. So that's a bit of a shame. So if I can get into an okay position out of the opening, then I'm sort of happy. And I do often, I enjoy trying new openings. So I'll quite often play something I haven't played before.
That's good. I mean, first of all, because as you mentioned, I think the types of tournaments you're playing, there can be lead time for the opponent. So you don't want to be sort of like a stationary target for your opponents. But I think that some people struggle with finding the confidence to play something new. Has that ever been an issue for you, Natasha? And do you have any advice for someone who might feel like, you know, I want to play this new opening, but I'm so much more comfortable with what I've been playing for a long time?
Yeah. I suppose sometimes this isn't going to sound great, but sometimes it's born out of you're actually not feeling happy with the thing you normally play. So you want to just try something different. So I in that situation, it's not that I don't have to feel particularly confident to try the new thing. I just want to try something different and also I've got, like, in my repertoire, certainly for my white repertoire, I've got three different starting moves that I use regularly. So I can kind of vary it like that and look at what the opponent plays and vary that way. But also it's actually more what mood I'm in as to what I play. And black, I have two main openings against E4, and against D4 I have several different ones that I try, although yes, I do some more than others, of course. So I have different ones I can do, and then I do occasionally sort of throw in something I haven't played before and just see what happens.
That's a good attitude. It's impressive. And Matthew, what's been your approach to openings?
I was playing a particular D4 line, and I just got into a rut with it. And I just realized that I had to change it to something else. So from there, I realized it was much better if I change it a bit more often than I was doing. So last season I was playing a particular thing. This season is why I'm playing something completely different. And I've really enjoyed the kind of more positional understanding I got with this season's opening. And I'm just about to start completely overhauling my black openings, which have always been very similar. And I think as you go up the rating scale, you also need to evolve it because stuff that worked at one level just won't work, you know, one or two steps up. And you need to get a bit more theoretical and understand the kind of middle game positions a bit more. So the kind of the theory work goes up once you get past 1800. And to do that, I try and cast my net very widely. If I'm playing a particular opening or want to learn it, then I'll see what's on Chessable. I'll see what books I've got or could get. I'll see what chess-based DVDs I've got or could get. I'll look at some online videos stuff if there's something available. Chess-based database I'll go through as well and have a look at what's going on there. And then I'll bring all of that together and decide which lines I want to play. Usually probably just following one particular course, whether that's a Chessable course or a chess-based thing or whatever. But where I don't like the lines, then I'm using all these other sources to find the one that I like.
Okay. And then
I might actually put it in a private Chessable course myself, these extra lines, build them up into something. And I may use that for spaced repetition, but I may also use it as a very quick reference tool. Because if you're at a tournament and all you've got is your phone, you know, you're not dialing into your chess-based database. But it's much easier to just quickly access your lines that you hold in a private Chessable course. So I've used that quite a bit and found that quite useful. And then post-morteming your games is absolutely vital for all types of learning and analyzing. But obviously, you know, where was I out of my book in the opening, and what can I learn as a result of, you know, the next few moves in particular, I found very useful.
All right, great advice there. And are either of you guys working with a coach?
No, but I do talk to strong players on stuff, and so not a coach exactly.
Okay.
So I've used some coaches ad hoc over the past few years, kind of deliberately so, partly because I use the chess mood content and approach as a kind of regular coach, if you like, talking to me and giving me the stuff that I want. But I use a coach to kind of check in on where I am and where I think, would you just have a look at these recent games and give me some pointers as to what I should study next?
So you pay them for that? Or is this like someone you're friendly with? Or
It might be either. Depends on who I'm using. Okay. I've paid for, you know, a local IM to come and help me for a couple of hours, which was great. And we looked at my choices of piece trading, and I need to go away and work on that. And then I don't need the coach to, you know, monitor my progress.
Because, right. Yeah, exactly.
As you've probably worked out, I'm reasonably disciplined about what I want to do once I decide what I want to learn. And then there's a colleague of mine who's one of the highest rated players at our club. We did a kind of Zoom call for an hour. He looked at some of my games, and he just gave me a couple of pointers. And one was this position in this game, it's like this Capablanca game against William Winter, I think it was. So go and have a look at that. And actually, you may want to study some classical games. And so I went away and looked at that one game and then thought, yeah, I do want to study some classical games. When I was taking my FIDE coaching course, pretty much every trainer on that course said, go and study more classical games. So I used the Chess Mood 100 classical games and kind of did one of those a day, basically.
Okay.
Until it was done.
Yeah, there's some beautiful games in there.
It's a good thing. So the coach then is just kind of checking in with me on my, I'm using them as a check-in at a particular point when I want some advice that I can't quite give myself or find myself on what I need to fine tune next. And then I can go and do it. You know, other people will use coaches in other ways, and that's absolutely great too. You know, some people I coach one to one want something more regular, and that's fine too.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, there's so much I could talk about. I mean, but between Natasha's interest in games and Matthew, I mean, you've been involved in chess since you've come back in so many different aspects of the game. Are there any other sort of major observations you have from this sort of re-entry into the chess world, Matthew?
Well, I suppose if you have taken a break for quite a while and you're wondering if you should get back in, yeah, start soon. Don't put it off. I found you won't regret it. I had some time away doing some other stuff, and that was fine too. But I'm really pleased I got back into it, and it's just become, you know, a bigger and bigger part of what I do. So I'd certainly advise that. I think when we were talking about junior players earlier, I think the typical standard of a junior player now is just so much better than it was when I was playing. The things my kids know and understand compared with what I knew when I was 12, it's just night and day. And I think that's a lot about the coaching methods, the availability of material, internet chess, and so on. You know, I mean, I barely had a chess book. I just kind of taught myself, and that would only ever get me so far. And I think the availability of material now is just fantastic. You know, the challenge is, you know, not where do I get something from, but from this vast array, what do I actually choose? And I think overall, particularly when you're getting back into it, don't obsess about openings. you know, games below 1800 are mostly settled by tactics and end games. So that's not a bad place to start. You just got to get a playable position in the middle game and focus on that. And you'll learn your theory as you go up the rating level.
Couldn't agree more. Definitely some good advice there. And Natasha, so you mentioned you've got these big tournaments coming up, sort of national stage. Does this mean that you have to set aside the shogi, or like, you know, how does that work when you've got so many other interests competing with chess?
It's true, actually. Yeah. And I have a shogi online match I need to do each month, certainly. Which I will play, and I also have this online monthly abstract games competition. You have to learn 4 new games in the month.
Wow.
And this is really hardcore, crazy stuff. And some of my friends are just very good at all these different types of games. So I go and I have sort of online practices with them. But what I will do is say I'm not available for the month of July because it will just be too much. So I've got to learn Hive and what's this other one? I can't even remember the names of the games. Hive is about surrounding a queen bee with ants or something, which actually looks like quite a nice game. But that one's for June, so I'm doing that. But then July I will have a month off learning new games and concentrate just on the chess.
Makes sense. Well, Natasha, it was good to catch up, and I certainly wish you luck
in
the chess.
Thank you.
And Matthew, you'll be at the British Championship too?
Oh, yeah. And we're also doing a joint kind of lecture on Zwischenzugs championships as well. So
Wednesday at the British Championships, we'll be there.
Excellent. Yes. Okay. And if any listeners, I mean, of course, they should check out the Chessable course, Zwischenzug. Any other way, if they have any questions or concerns, I'm guessing you guys will be active in the comments on the course, if nothing else.
Yes, definitely. Yes. And we'll try. Yes, we'll try and keep doing events. And I don't know. We had plans to post Zwischenzugs when we saw them, but we haven't. They're not far advanced yet. So we'll have to keep an eye out for that.
Sounds good. Okay, well, it's been great chatting with both of you, and good luck in the upcoming tournaments.
Thank you, and good luck with your book as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Looking forward to adding that one to my book collection.
Thank you. Yeah, a lot of the stuff we've talked about is touched on in the book. So as you're talking, I'm like, do I need to go back and add something about this? Do I add something about this?
No.
But that process never ends, you know? So at some point you just have to, you know, it's like sending your kids off to school. You close the door and, you know, hope for the best. So that's about where I am. But thanks, guys. This has been fun.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.